Chapter 2 Light filtered back, filling his closed eyes with a membrane of illuminated redness. He opened his eyes, lifted his head to look around him, to search out Heather or the doctor. He lay alone in the room, no one else. A bureau with a cracked vanity mirror, ugly old light fixtures jutting from the grease-saturated walls. And from somewhere nearby, the blare of a TV set. He was not in a hospital. And Heather was not with him. He experienced her absence, the total emptiness of everything, because of her. God, he thought, what's happened? The pain in his chest had vanished, along with so much else. Shakily, he pushed back the soiled wool blanket, sat up, rubbed his forehead reflexively, gathered together his vitality. This is a hotel room, he realized. A lousy, bug-infested, cheap wino hotel. No curtains, no bathroom. Like he had lived in years ago, at the start of his career. Back when he had been unknown and had no money. The dark days he always shut out of his memory as best he could. Money. He groped at his clothes, discovered that he no longer wore the hospital gown, but had back, in wrinkled condition, his hand-tailored silk suit. And, in the inner coat pocket, the wad of high-denomination bills, the money he had intended to take to Vegas. At least he had that. Swiftly, he looked around for a phone. No, of course not. But there'd be one in the lobby. But whom to call? Heather? Al Bliss, his agent? Maury Mann, the producer of his TV show? His attorney, Bill Wolfer? Or all of them? As soon as possible, perhaps. Unsteadily, he managed to get to his feet. He stood swaying, cursing for reasons he did not understand. An animal instinct held him. He readied himself, his strong six body, to fight. But he could not discern the antagonist, and that frightened him. For the first time in as long as he could remember, he felt panic. Has a lot of time passed? He asked himself. He could not tell. He had no sense of it either way. Daytime. Quibbles zooming and bleating in the skies outside the dirty glass of his window. He looked at his watch. It read 10:30. So what? It could be 1,000 years off for all he knew. His watch couldn't help him. But the phone would. He made his way out into the dust-saturated corridor, found the stairs, descended step by step, holding on to the rail until at last he stood in the depressing, empty lobby with its ratty old overstuffed chairs. Fortunately, he had change. He dropped a $1 gold piece into the slot, dialed Al Bliss's number. "Bliss Talent Agency," Al's voice came presently. "Listen," Jason said, "I don't know where I am. In the name of Christ, come and get me. Get me out of here. Get me someplace else. You understand, Al, do you?" Silence from the phone. And then in a distant, detached voice, Al Bliss said, "Who am I talking to?" He snarled his answer. "I don't know you, Mr. Jason Taverner," Al Bliss said, again in his most neutral, uninvolved voice. "Are you sure you have the right number? Who did you want to talk to?" "To you, Al. Al Bliss, my agent. What happened in the hospital? How'd I get out of there into here? Don't you know?" His panic ebbed as he forced control on himself. He made his words come out reasonably. "Can you get hold of Heather for me?" "Miss Hart?" Al said and chuckled, and did not answer. "You," Jason said savagely, "are through as my agent. Period. No matter what the situation is, you are out." In his ear, Al Bliss chuckled again, and then, with a click, the line became dead. Al Bliss had hung up. "I'll kill the son of a bitch," Jason said to himself. "I'll tear that fat, balding little bastard into inch-square pieces. What was he trying to do to me? I don't understand. What, all of a sudden, does he have against me? What the hell did I do to him, for Christ's sakes? He's been my friend and agent 19 years. And nothing like this has ever happened before." "I'll try Bill Wolfer," he decided. "He's always in his office or on call. I'll be able to get hold of him and find out what this is all about." He dropped a second gold dollar into the phone's slot and, from memory, once more dialed. "Wolfer and Blaine, attorneys at law," a female receptionist's voice sounded in his ear. "Let me talk to Bill," Jason said. "This is Jason Taverner. You know who I am." The receptionist said, "Mr. Wolfer is in court today. Would you care to speak to Mr. Blaine instead, or shall I have Mr. Wolfer call you back when he returns to the office later on this afternoon?" "Do you know who I am?" Jason said. "Do you know who Jason Taverner is? Do you watch TV?" His voice almost got away from him at that point. He heard it break and rise. With great effort, he regained control over it, but he could not stop his hands from shaking. His whole body, in fact, shook. "I'm sorry, Mr. Taverner," the receptionist said. "I really can't talk for Mr. Wolfer, or..." "Do you watch TV?" he said. "Yes." "And you haven't heard of me? The Jason Taverner Show. At 9 on Tuesday nights." "I'm sorry, Mr. Taverner. You really must talk directly to Mr. Wolfer. Give me the number of the phone you're calling from, and I'll see to it that he calls you back sometime today." He hung up. "I'm insane," he thought. "Or she's insane. She and Al Bliss, that son of a bitch. God." He moved shakily away from the phone, seated himself in one of the faded, overstuffed chairs. It felt good to sit. He shut his eyes and breathed slowly and deeply, and pondered. "I have $5,000 in government high-denomination bills," he told himself, "so I'm not completely helpless. And that thing is gone from my chest, including its feeding tubes. They must have been able to get at them surgically in the hospital. So at least I'm alive. I can rejoice over that." "Has there been a time lapse?" he asked himself. "Where's a newspaper?" He found an L.A. Times on a nearby couch, read the date, October 12th, 1988. No time lapse. This was the day after his show, and the day Marilyn had sent him, dying, to the hospital. An idea came to him. He searched through the sections of newspaper until he found the entertainment column. Currently, he was appearing nightly at the Persian Room of the Hollywood Hilton. Had been, in fact, for 3 weeks, but, of course, less Tuesdays because of his show. The ad for him, which the hotel people had been running during the past 3 weeks, did not seem to be on the page anywhere. He thought groggily, maybe it's been moved to another page. He thereupon combed that section of the paper thoroughly. Ad after ad for entertainers, but no mention of him. And his face had been on the entertainment page of some newspaper or another for 10 years, without an ellipsis. "I'll make one more try," he decided. "I'll try Maury Mann." Fishing out his wallet, he searched for the slip on which he had written Maury's number. His wallet was very thin. All his identification cards were gone. Cards that made it possible for him to stay alive. Cards that got him through Paul and Nat barricades without being shot or thrown into a forced labor camp. "I can't live 2 hours without my ID," he said to himself. "I don't even dare walk out of the lobby of this run-down hotel and onto the public sidewalk. They'll assume I'm a student or teacher escaped from one of the campuses. I'll spend the rest of my life as a slave doing heavy manual labor. I am what they call an unperson. So my first job, he thought, is to stay alive. The hell with Jason Taverner as a public entertainer. I can worry about that later. He could feel within his brain the powerful six determined constituents moving already into focus. I am not like other men, he told himself. I will get out of this, whatever it is. Somehow. For example, he realized, with all this money I have on me, I can get myself down to Watts and buy phony ID cards. A whole wallet full of them. There must be 100 little operators scratching away at that, from what I've heard. But I never thought I'd be using one of them. Not Jason Taverner. Not a public entertainer with an audience of 30 million. Among all those 30 million people, he asked himself, isn't there one who remembers me? If remember is the right word. I'm talking as if a lot of time has passed, that I'm an old man now, a has-been, feeding off former glories. And that's not what's going on. Returning to the phone, he looked up the number of the Birth Registration Control Center in Iowa. With several gold coins, he managed to reach them at last, after much delay. My name is Jason Taverner, he told the clerk. I was born in Chicago at Memorial Hospital on December 16, 1946. Would you please confirm and release a copy of my certificate of birth? I need it for a job I'm applying for. Yes, sir. The clerk put the line on hold. Jason waited. The clerk clicked back on. Mr. Jason Taverner, born in Cook County on December 16, 1946. Yes, Jason said. We have no birth registration form for such a person at that time and place. Are you absolutely sure of the fact, sir? You mean, do I know my name and when and where I was born? His voice again managed to escape his control, but this time he let it. Panic flooded him. Thanks, he said, and hung up, shaking violently now. Shaking in his body and in his mind. I don't exist, he said to himself. There is no Jason Taverner. There never was and there never will be. The hell with my career. I just want to live. If someone or something wants to eradicate my career, okay, do it. But aren't I going to be allowed to exist at all? Wasn't I even born? Something stirred in his chest. With terror, he thought, they didn't get the feed tubes out entirely. Some of them are still growing and feeding inside of me. That goddamn tramp of a no-talent girl. I hope she winds up walking the streets for 2 bits a try. After what I did for her, getting her those 2 auditions for A&R people. But hell, I did get to layer a lot. I suppose it comes out even. Returning to his hotel room, he took a good long look at himself in the fly-specked vanity mirror. His appearance hadn't changed, except that he needed a shave. No older, no more lines, no gray hair visible. The good shoulders and biceps, the fat-free waist that let him wear the current form-fitting men's clothing. And that's important to your image, he said to himself. What kind of suits you can wear, especially those tucked-in waist numbers. I must have 50 of them, he thought. Or did have. Where are they now, he asked himself. The bird is gone, and in what meadow does it now sing? Or however that goes. Something from the past, out of his days at school. Forgotten until this moment. Strange, he thought, What drifts up into your mind when you're in an unfamiliar and ominous situation? Sometimes the most trivial stuff imaginable. If wishes were horses, then beggars might fly. Stuff like that. It's enough to drive you crazy. He wondered how many Paul and Nat check stations there were between this miserable hotel and the closest ID forger in Watts. 10? 13? 2? For me, he thought, all it takes is one. One random check by a mobile vehicle and crew of 3. With their damn radio gear connecting them to Paul Nat Data Central in Kansas City, where they keep the dossiers. He rolled back his sleeve and examined his forearm. Yes, there it was. His tattooed ident number. His somatic license plate to be carried by him throughout his life, buried at last with him in his longed-for grave. Well, the Pauls and Nats at the mobile check station would read off the ident number to Kansas City, and then... what then? Was his dossier still there, or was it gone too, like his birth certificate? And if it wasn't there, what would the Paul Nat bureaucrats think it meant? A clerical error. Somebody misfiled the microfilm packet that made up the dossier. It'll turn up. Someday, when it doesn't matter, when I've spent 10 years of my life in a quarry on Luna using a manual pickaxe. If the dossier isn't there, he mused, they'll assume I'm an escaped student, because it's only students who don't have Paul Nat dossiers. And even some of them, the important ones, the leaders, they're in there too. I am at the bottom of life, he realized. And I can't even climb my way up to mere physical existence. Me, a man who yesterday had an audience of 30 million. Someday, somehow, I will grope my way back to them. But not now. There are other things that come first. The bare bones of existence that every man is born with. I don't even have that. But I will get it. A 6 is not an ordinary. No ordinary could have physically or psychologically survived what's happened to me, especially the uncertainty, as I have. A 6, no matter what the external circumstances, will always prevail. Because that's the way they genetically defined us. He left his hotel room once more, walked downstairs and up to the desk. A middle-aged man with a thin mustache was reading a copy of Box magazine. He did not look up, but said, "Yes, sir." Jason brought out his packet of government bills, laid a $500 note on the counter before the clerk. The clerk glanced at it, glanced again, this time with wide-opened eyes. Then he cautiously looked up into Jason's face, questioningly. "My ident cards were stolen," Jason said. "That $500 bill is yours if you can get me to someone who can replace them. If you're going to do it right now. I'm not going to wait." Wait to be picked up by a Paul or a Nat, he thought. Caught here in this run-down, dingy hotel. "Or caught on the sidewalk in front of the entrance," the clerk said. "I'm a telepath of sorts. I know this hotel isn't much, but we have no bugs. Once we had Martian sand fleas, but no more." He picked up the $500 bill. "I'll get you to someone who can help you," he said. Studying Jason's face intently, he paused, then said, "You think you're world famous?" "Well, we get all kinds." "Let's go," Jason said harshly. "Now." "Right now," the clerk said, and reached for his shiny plastic coat.